My name is Jane Tipping. I was born in 1951, and for the first 10 years of my life, I lived in Pinner in Middlesex in a detached suburban house with my sister, who's 3 years younger than me, and my mother and my father. And my father was a BOAC pilot, and so he used to fly a lot to America. He used to bring back all sorts of wonderful things that you couldn't possibly buy in this country. The suitcase that he used to have was a big blue suitcase called a Globetrotter. And everything inside the suitcase was cold, because obviously in the air pressure. And he'd open the suitcase, and my sister and I absolutely adored paper dolls. They were the Lennon sisters, Connie Francis, Heavenly Blue Wedding. It's 1950s cardboard dolls that we used to cut out. At the bottom of his suitcase, there were the paper dolls and the LPs, which were just stacked flat right at the bottom of the suitcase.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth, dear, and it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Maggie, babe, and it keeps it out of sight. You know when
my father brought back this small EP
with his teeth, babe,
and it had a picture of Bobby Darin on the front, and he put that on and started singing to it, and it seemed so different and so cool.
So there's never a trace of red.
And my parents would light up their cigarettes and click their fingers and get cocktails out, and it was like a completely different era.
Get someone sneaking round the corner. Could that someone,
like part of America, came into our households.
There's a tugboat down by the river, don't you know? Where a cement bag just drooping on down. Oh, that cement is...
I'm Susie Quattro. I was born and raised in Detroit, Michigan. My father was an engineer during the day, and he played music at night, and he has five kids, and we all play various instruments, and he always had nighttime jobs. He was a part-time musician. I remember the Bobby Darin version. Of course, my dad did more of a dee-dee-dee-dee version of it, and he used to let me go with him sometimes on a Sunday. He took me to a show, and he let me sit in front of the band and play the song on the bongos. Okay, boys, we're going to do this. Mack the knife. Now, I need it nice and old-fashioned, corny, deet, 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 like my dad used to play. Okay? I'm going to start you off. Here we go. They all complained, by the way, my band, when I asked them to play this song in this corny way that my dad used to play, but they did it, and it sounds exactly like my dad. I can only ever think of me sitting in front of my father's band as a child instead of being at church and getting 25 cents at the end of it. That's what's in my mind. He paid me a quarter, yeah, and then I went and wasted it in the bowling machine like a jerk. It was a huge part of my life. I guess you could say it was the first time I performed in front of a live audience, you know, so that is forever in my psyche. So I owe my beginnings to Mack the Knife.
God, old Maggie is back.
I'm Lucy Moore. I'm a writer and historian, and I wrote a book about Jack Sheppard. Jack Sheppard was executed in 1724, and an ambitious young poet, John Gay, began writing a version of his life, which became known as The Beggar's Opera and came out in 1728. Gay based his central character, the gentleman highwayman, Macheath, on Jack Sheppard, who was known as Gentleman Jack. He was unusual because he had these thrilling escapes from prison, four dramatic prison escapes which captured the imagination of the London public, and he became a superstar in early Georgian London. He was also special because he refused to turn any of his accomplices in, and he'd never used violence in any of his crimes. And he was also loved by the public because he was a great ladies' man. He had a lot of girlfriends, and he's one of the sources for the name Jack the Lad. He was determined to sort of live life to the full. He escaped from Newgate, having been visited by the king's painter. The turnkeys were charging a shilling a go just to see him in his cell. He managed to escape dramatically through, you know, six locked doors and breaking through a chimney. Gets out, doesn't hide out, as you might expect. Instead, steals himself a dashing new suit of clothes and a sword and a pair of diamond studs, picks up his two latest girlfriends and goes out carousing in Covent Garden, where he's arrested that night, roaring drunk with his girlfriend Moll Frisky. He's taken back to Newgate and he's hanged. When Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht produced their version of The Beggar's Opera 200 years afterwards, they called it the Threepenny Opera, and they based it in Victorian London, a much more menacing atmosphere than Georgian London, and they gave Macheath a different character, so he's no longer the lovable rogue of the gay version, but he's become a murderous, threatening, violent criminal. And this, I think, reflects the much more menacing atmosphere of 1928 Germany, where it first came out, the end of the Weimar Republic, the rise of Nazism. He's reflecting a different kind of social reality.
I'm Stephen Hinton. I'm a music historian and I teach at Stanford University in California. The song Mack the Knife was a last minute addition. The whole production was absolute chaos. Nobody thought this piece would succeed. They were rehearsing into the wee hours of the morning, but they wanted to create a song at the last minute to describe the figure of Macheath. Brecht composed the words to what was called Die Moritat von Mackie Messer, and Weill set the music. And so what the song, which is a kind of street ballad, describes are the various things that he gets up to with murder and extortion.
I'm Steve Parker. I'm the Henry Simon Professor of German at the University of Manchester, and I've written a new literary biography of Bertolt Brecht. Brecht himself recorded a version in 1929. It's one of only two sound recordings that we've got of Brecht singing his own songs, and the opening with the barrel organ just sent a shiver through me, I must say.
Und der Heibe, der hat Zähne, und die trägt im Gesicht, und Macheath, der hat sein Messer, doch das Messer sieht man nicht.
And to hear Brecht's voice, I'm always reminded of what David Bowie said about Bob Dylan's voice, a voice of sand and glue. In his own way, Brecht's voice was a little bit like that, with these very, very rasped R sounds.
My name is Malcolm Clark, and I'm a filmmaker. I was approached by someone who said that they had found this extraordinary story about a European filmmaker. His name was Kurt Geron, and he was a German Jew. And Kurt Geron was a singer, he was an actor, he was a director, and one of the things that he kind of distinguished himself in doing was being the first person to ever sing publicly Mack the Knife. And it became, in essence, his signature tune.
Und der Haifisch, der hat Zähne, und die trägt im Gesicht. Und Macheath, der hat ein Messer, doch das Messer sieht man nicht.
Kurt's career was hugely successful. But when the Nazis took over, shortly after Kristallnacht, everyone, of Jewish faith was ultimately hunted down. And finally, they came to his set when he was directing a movie, and they removed him from the set right in the middle of a scene. They actually stopped the scene, sang on his set the Horst Wessel song, and then they replaced him right there and then by a National Socialist director, and his career was effectively ruined.
My name is John Bird, and I'm the founder of The Big Issue. The first time I remember hearing Mack the Knife, sung by Bobby Darin, was about 1958, and I was 12. And I was walking from Fulham Broadway to Parsons Green through a park called the Ilbrook Common, which is still there. And people would be with their windows open, and it would have been on the radio. I'm walking along, and I'm hearing this music, and I'm loving it. And I immediately picked up on the lyrics, which was about death and murder, which to me seemed brilliant.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth, dear, and it shows them pearly white.
So when I heard Mack the Knife, I thought, I love this, because it was like the glorification of crime, which to me was where every sane member of the working classes should be, committing crime.
You know when that shark bite with its teeth big, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy.
My life at the time was tragic. It was horrible. Because at the age of 10, I'd been done for shoplifting, and at the age of 11, I'd been done for bunking off school, and at the age of 12, I was done for housebreaking and stealing stuff. I was obsessed. One day, I would murder my father. And I planned it. I used to lay in the park and try and work out ways of murdering him. My favourite idea was to follow him early in the morning to Fulham Broadway Station, and just as the train was going to come in, I was going to push him on the line. So murder to me was murder, death was quite real. And this song was just so wonderful because it made murder and crime seem exciting and interesting. It was a bit like, you know, discovering that there was maybe something I could do in the future, which was become a criminal or a murderer. Precisely 10 years later, 68, when I was 22, I was a kind of crim. I'd gone from being a supporter of Adolf Hitler and anybody who could harm anybody into being a Marxist. I got rid of all my hatred. So 10 years after Mack the Knife, I'm shoplifting the complete works of Bertolt Brecht from a bookshop in South Kensington. And then, amongst it all, I discover the Throppney Opera, Die Groschen Opera. So the song, it's like a link back. It's a kind of remembrance of that journey, that first journey I made from Fulham Broadway to Parsons Green. So I look back and I think I'm really glad that I managed to escape from that terrible life.
Look out, old Mac is back.
Things went quiet, as far as the Threepenny Opera is concerned, until the early 1950s, when the piece was performed at Brandeis University in the well-known arrangement by Mark Blitzstein, who not only arranged the music, but also did the translation, very free translation of the text, with Leonard Bernstein as the conductor. Lotte Lenya was Kurt Weill's widow when Mack the Knife was becoming so famous. They had been married since the mid-1920s. Lotte Lenya was also a singer. The famous performance which we have on record by Louis Armstrong, she happened to be in the studio for that. She was interested in what was going on with Weill's music in general and supporting it. So she was there in the studio, which is, in fact, I'm sure, why at one point in this recording, Louis Armstrong says,
Lottie Lenya.
Lottie Lenya.
Because she was there, they actually ended up doing a recording together.
On the right here.
Now that Mac is back in town.
Ella Fitzgerald did a famous version. She does a recording of it, but she forgets the words. And so she just improvises the words.
And Louis Armstrong, they made a record. Oh, but they did. And now Ella, Ella, and her fellas, we're making a wreck. What a wreck of Mac tonight.
Oh, Stevie Dundee!
Kurt Garron left Germany, weirdly, after this kind of hugely successful career. He ended up performing on stage, as he'd done right at the beginning of his career, in cabaret at the Schauburg Theatre, which was a Jewish theatre in Holland. But he must have known that the Germans were coming, the Germans were predators, they were not going to leave the rest of Europe alone. And interestingly, although he had the opportunity to leave, Marlene Dietrich pleaded with him to go to Hollywood. Peter Lorre offered to help him find work. The problem was that when they did find him a job, when he was offered a job in Hollywood, and because they would not sail him to America first class, he had to go second class. They sent him a ticket. Because they wouldn't give him a first-class ticket, he turned them down. Finally, what happened was that the Nazis, who had already invaded Holland, were in control of Holland, they were rounding up the Jews. But interestingly, there was one camp that was quite different to all the others in the Nazi concentration camp system. It was called Theresienstadt, and it was a camp for distinguished Jews, for famous Jews, for Jews who had achieved something. He was sent to Theresienstadt. And I do know that Kurt, on many occasions during his time in Theresienstadt, sang Mack the Knife, mainly, according to the accounts, to the old and the sick and the dying prisoners. There was something about Mack the Knife that was particularly beloved and familiar. Kurt had nothing to gain, really, by doing this. He would go to the tops of the buildings, into the attics where they kept the sickest and the people who were the closest to death. And without any accompaniment, he would stand among those dying prisoners and he would sing the song that he was most famous for.
My name is Lenny Kaye, and I'm a guitar player for Patti Smith. In 1970, I was working at Village Oldies on Bleecker Street in the West Village, and Patti Smith walked in. And we dance and we talk, and one day she walked in the store and asked if I played a little guitar because she was thinking of having a poetry reading at St. Mark's Church, and she wanted to shake it up a little bit. I believe Sam Shepard, the great playwright, had suggested that maybe she might want to put a little rock and roll into her poetry reading. She came in, and we spoke. I said, sure. You know, she asked me if I thought I could do a car crash on the guitar. And I said, well, that's my specialty because all the other stuff is beyond my capabilities. On February 10th, 1971, we had our very first performance poetry reading, opening up Gerard Malanga at the St. Mark's Poetry Project. And when Patti looked at the date, she saw it was Bertolt Brecht's birthday. And Patti really likes to celebrate anniversaries of all types, birthdays, death days, And when she saw it was Bertolt Brecht's birthday, she suggested perhaps we could do one of his songs. Mack the Knife came easily to hand. It had three chords, or at least the three chords I could play. And we opened our reading at St. Mark's Church. Probably the first notes I ever played with her in a public setting were Mack the Knife. We didn't think to record it. Luckily, Bridget Polk, who recorded most of the Warhol-esque doings in Manhattan at that time, had her tape recorder there.
Okay, today is like Bertolt Brecht's birthday, and it's February 10th. And in tribute to Bertolt Brecht, first thing I want to do is like just a little version, my version of like one of his great masterpieces, Mack the Knife. Okay. Oh, that shark has such teeth, and they stick out through his face.
The thing about Mack the Knife, if I look back on it and let my imagination ramble, in a weird way, you know, Patty is probably more like Mack Heath. Anyway, it's a good song to set us off on our narrative of musical evolution because, you know, who has a shark's bait with his teeth, dear? There's a lot of kind of suave menace in that song. Patty has a kind of Mack Heath thing. She's kind of sly and a good mischief maker.
Maggie Baldur, she was found with a knife in her throat.
And I think it's a character that Patty has certainly stepped in and out of over the years. And, you know, I feel privileged to have been a part of her Three Penny Opera. Really, it was just supposed to be that night. And it wasn't even meant to last past that night. We were able to do it for the purity of the moment, to send it out into the air. And in truth, I never backed up Patty again until 2.5 years later when we started playing more regularly. I don't think anyone has any sense of how the future is going to turn out. We didn't set out to have a rock and roll band. I think if we had, it would have turned out much lesser than it actually did. All we tried to do was keep up with our imaginations as it found places to become reality. And by the time we actually had a rock and roll band, 4 years after our first reading, it sounded like us. We had no preconceptions of who we could be, and so we could be anything. And that, to me, is what's most special about that moment in time. It kind of was there almost by chronological accident. You know, it happened to be Bertolt Brecht's birthday, but it's a great touchstone of our beginnings, and I always like to give it a little salute.
The propaganda ministry in Berlin was informed that Kurt Geron was at Theresienstadt. And so the camp commandant, Rahm, took Geron aside and said, "You can live. You will not be put on a transport and sent to Auschwitz. If you agree to make a film, to show Theresienstadt as a place of humanity and culture, you can survive the war." And it was a Faustian pact, you know. It was a deal with the devil. We'll let you make a film, but you have to make our film. And he actually made a great movie. We only have 34 minutes of it surviving. And so immediately the film canisters actually were handed to the SS. Kurt, within 2 days, was ordered to report to the railway track, 6 in the morning. Everyone in the film, all the kids, all the young women, the cute young women who the Nazis had manufactured bathing costumes for so that they could film a scene where they were diving into a swimming pool that, of course, the prisoners had to dig specifically for the film. All those people were put on the last transport to Auschwitz. No one knew it was going to be the last transport, but that's what it turned out to be. There was a woman who I actually did not put in my film because I didn't meet her until one of the screenings in New York City, several months after the film was complete, and she stood up in the movie theater in the question and answer period, and she said, "I was on the transport with Kurt Geron," and she was a little girl, and she remembers seeing him get on the train, and she also remembers him being pulled off the train first before any of the other prisoners. The loudspeakers that greeted the train when it arrived in Birkenau were calling his name, and he was marched by the SS to the gas chambers. The story which went around the camp in the weeks following that, which this lady heard, was that the guards, when they realized that it was actually the great Geron, they cajoled him and taunted him and ordered him to sing his famous song, his last hurrah, walking into the gas chamber, was being ordered by the gas chamber guards to sing Mack the Knife.